This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
It's in the news. Time to make up your mind. Time to choose. But I see nothing to gain and nothing to lose.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Coming to you from beautiful Fort Worth, Texas, at beautiful Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in Fort Worth, where we talk all things music, where it has been, where it is now, where it may be going. And we are thrilled today because we have a true Texas legend here, in every sense of the word, a guy who's seen it all, or done most things. The great Gary P. Nunn is here today. How are you, sir?
Oh, good morning, Phil. Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Well, hey, man, this just thrills everybody here.
Thank you.
We have a great following out there, not only here in Texas, but worldwide. I get emails from people in the UK and Canada and stuff who are big fans of all kinds of music. So needless to say, man, when they see that Gary P. Nunn is going to be on the podcast, we'll be getting that website. Just going to be firing up. So we're looking forward to that.
Well,
that's
great. I'm glad to have the opportunity to visit with the folks out there in the world.
Well, you know, we get a lot of young guys on here. No offense to them. I produce a lot of young songwriters. They come in and they'll tell some story about last week when things got out of hand at a party. But the guy's 22 years old or something. I'm like, man, we need somebody in here who's seen some years, who's played a few gigs in his time. Some real war stories maybe down the road. We'll see how that goes. How did you get into music originally? Did you grow up in a musical family? Is this something you ventured out on your own?
Not really. My folks were school teachers, and they encouraged us early on. I remember when we were little, I guess I was 8 years old or something.
Yeah.
We lived up in Oklahoma, and folks would cart us over to Colgate, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. Mrs. Stalder to take piano lessons. So I took piano lessons about a year there, and then we moved to another town. And so I didn't continue the lessons, but I kind of had a natural ear for it. And
you could pick out melodies, notes.
I just started sitting down and playing it from that point on.
Right.
I just followed. Of course, later on, we moved out to Texas, and in sixth grade, I got in the junior high band.
Yeah.
I wanted to play a trumpet, you know, because back in those days, you know, the trumpet players were the hot guys.
Is that right?
Big band. Well,
yeah,
big band stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was always into the band stuff, the orchestra.
Who are some guys you listened to in the house there? I mean, your parents have records of guys?
Well, gosh, I don't know. You know, we didn't. We were pretty poor, and we had a radio.
Yeah, so, right.
You know, I spent most of my days, playing ball until the sun went down. Mom made me come in.
What'd you play?
Oh, well, you know, we just were sandlot baseball, softball, and stuff like that.
So how'd you get into the whole, how old were you when you kind of got into maybe the country, the writing songs kind of thing? Was there an artist you got into, or maybe a defining moment
something? I actually started out in about the eighth grade. I heard about it. Of course, I was playing football and going to school and wasn't in the music and wasn't in the band at that time. So I heard that this fella got a guitar, and I didn't even know him.
Uh-oh.
But I went straight. I made acquaintance with him.
Yeah.
And And I spent about the next 5-6 years more or less at his house
playing his guitar.
So he had a guitar, and so we started a little band, and we knew one songs. And the older guys, there was this band called the Emeralds.
Yeah.
And we were like
Oklahoma band?
Well, this was actually in Brownfield, Texas after we moved to Texas.
Right, right.
And so they taught us one song, and so I've always been the utility guy. I played what?
Right.
There was three guys that had guitar.
Right.
And they didn't have a drummer. So
right.
I went to the band hall, and I got a marching bass drum and a snare yeah. drum, and my tom-tom was a marching snare, and some older guys loaned me a cymbal stand and a foot pedal.
That's how you always get work, man. You just kind of wear a lot of hats, you know. Yeah. Say, hey, I can play bass. You can pick it out.
Well, the funny part was we went out there. Because I'd never even sat on a drum kit until we actually went and played this show. And naturally, it was a slick wooden floor. And I started hitting that bass drum, and that bass drum just started marching across the floor. I'd have to get up every once in a while, go pull the bass drum back, and then
kicking it, just sliding off. Yeah. That's how the drum rug was invented.
Yeah,
years later.
Never thought about having those little stops on there or play on a rug or anything. And then there was an older fella who played drums in the high school jazz band, so mm-hmm. we hired him. They said, we need a bass player. So my friend Alton Nicholson went and he bought a bass.
Right.
It was a Precision bass. I wish I had it today.
You know? Yeah, oh, man.
Yeah.
You could pick him up for about $10.
This is about 1960.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so bought a Precision bass, and so I started playing bass. And so we played this band all through high school.
Yeah.
And we'd play for the teen canteens. And,
sure, yeah.
And after I go play a football game, then I go play a gig.
Were you singing some as well, or just kind of playing?
Well, you know, back in those days, early on, it was just instrumentals.
Oh, I see.
You know,
yeah,
we played Ventures and Freddie King. And then when Chuck Berry came along, you know, we started doing Chuck Berry songs, and then
I noticed you closed with Johnny B. Goode last night.
Oh yeah, well that's you
carried
know,
that, over from the old
it
days.
Is,
huh?
It is, it is exactly.
Good
and
stuff.
It always works, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah,
it always works. So
we did. I didn't mention maybe we played with Gary P. Nunn and his band last night here at the Stock Show in Fort Worth. How we kind of hooked up here. John was nice enough to. Get Gary in here, and we appreciate him being here today. Well, in our next little segment here, we're going to talk more about how Gary P. Nunn became who he is today, a little more getting out of high school and playing and falling in with, a whole bunch of Texas songwriters here in the coming years. We await that section. So stay tuned. More with Gary P. Nunn when we come back.
I told you so. Just wanna find my own way and be happy with where I go. The high speed chase.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast. Did you know you can go to philpritchard.com? You can download any one of our 14 albums for $4 a piece. We want you to have it all, so go check that out. Or call us here at the studio. Commerce Court at the studio, 817-733-5256. We are honored here. The great Gary P. Nunn has been sitting here with us today, sharing some old stories. We were catching up on how Gary P. Nunn came to be, folks. Playing as a young kid, playing on other guys' guitars, piano lessons, all that kind of fun stuff. I love hearing the backstory on everybody. So you're in Texas. You're playing high school. You know, and not really singing and writing yet. When does that maybe start to be a part of what you're doing?
Well, later on, there was this band in West Texas called the Fabulous Sparkles.
Right.
That's where the Fabulous Thunderbirds got their name, too.
Oh, is that right?
Jimmy,
I read about this.
Jimmy Vaughn was a young kid, and you know, they were just starting out at this time. And
where were they out of?
Well, they were out of Dallas.
Oh, okay.
Oak Cliff in Dallas.
What kind of stuff were they doing?
Yardbirds. And,
oh, okay.
You know, they
psychedelic
were kicking their drums off the stage.
And oh,
Jimmy Vaughn,
the fun stuff.
Was 14 when I first saw him.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So So anyway, we got to the Sparkles, and they were the rage of West Texas. Of course, I grew up on the Sparkles myself, and I idolized all the guys. And when I had an opportunity to play with them, I thought I'd just died and gone to heaven.
How'd that opportunity come to be, though?
Well, they had a breakup. Some of their guys had been together for so long, they had their differences of opinion. Of course, that's the way it always, you know, some of them drank and smoked, and some of them didn't.
Right.
And the ones that...
Artistic differences came floated to the fore. Now, were they getting you as a drummer, bass player, guitar player?
Yeah, it was, you know, two guitars, bass, and drums.
What were you going to be playing?
Well, actually, here I am, a utility guy.
Yeah.
You
can apply for all the
jobs.
They
had all that covered.
Uh-huh.
So that was when I first picked up a guitar and started strumming. I bought me a Tele for $150. I remember that you could get them off the wall. For
early 60s,
yeah.
Fender Telecaster.
Yeah, it's about mid-60s then.
It's not worth anything these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good thing you got rid of that.
And a far piece of organ.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, yeah. So this is when I'm back into the keyboard thing.
Okay.
So I got the far piece of organ and later bought a Vox organ.
Vox Continental.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then I got a custom organ. That wasn't worth a darn. Did you ever see one of those?
No. Who made custom?
It was a padded, you know, one of those padded things.
Like the amps with the pad.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And that it didn't have any power. And,
right.
And then I bought a little M3. I noticed you have one right here. In your
we have studio. a Hammond M3 organ right here. Yeah.
It didn't have any power, but we hauled it around. There was always too many guitar players for me. I always wanted to be a guitar player.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was, you'd have
so
to.
So what kind of, were y'all playing a lot of just clubs, dances, that kind
club
of thing?
Club dancing, and, you know, on the Spark. We traveled all over the state. You know, we were based in Lubbock, but you know, I was going to college, and we'd run to Beaumont or Houston, Texas over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And we were real big. They used to have the Roundup in Austin. Used to be a big deal. It was during spring rush season.
Yeah, right.
And Charlie Hatchett was an agent, and he'd bring us down.
I know Charlie.
$500 a night. That was top dollar in those days.
Does Charlie Hatchett still have his deal in Austin?
He is. He's
Charlie Hatchett agency. Yeah, he used to book us for stuff.
Right. That's
Charlie's early 90s.
Having some health problems now, but he still plays.
He's been around. Yeah.
He still has his band, the Chevelles.
So. I'll be darned. Yeah. Okay, that's good to hear.
Right.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, he's doing all right.
So you guys are out there doing the, is it kind of a surf psychedelic
stuff? Let's see, you know, we had come from the basis. Our material was like, let me think.
Yardbirds, you said?
No. We never get into that.
Yeah.
It was more like West Texas stuff. It was like Orbison.
Oh, there you go.
And Buddy Holly and Elvis, Lucky.
Sure.
The drummer. He was a great monster drummer.
Yeah.
And he was a great singer. And he was the leader of the band.
Oh, cool.
And
okay,
so
he
sang from the drums. And so we did a lot. And then we started getting into R&B. We did... I'll be there. What was the name of that band? We had one guy that sang R&B real good, Bobby Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And then one guy could do Chuck Berry real good. And then Lucky could do all the Orbison and Presley. And
y'all could do the hits of the day, all genres. Just had somebody in the band who could step up. And
But we never got into the psychedelic. Well, I say that we tried to get into it. We actually made a record.
Unsuccessful?
We tried to make a record.
A venture.
We did. We were on Hickory Records, you know.
Yeah.
And we were shared the label with Roy Orbison and the New Beats.
Yeah.
And Donovan was on.
Where was Hickory Records located?
Well, was Acuff and Rose.
Yeah.
In Nashville.
Okay.
And it was, Acuff and Rose Publishing Company.
Sure. Oh,
had all of.
So y'all had been signed.
Yeah, we were signed. Okay, we'd run up to Nashville on weekends and do and cut a few sides. But we did cut one. This one, Fuzz Tones, first came out. And so we cut this song called "Ye Ain't No Friend of Mine." And Lucky, he could have this kind of ragged, real kind of screaming type of voice.
Right.
And it's like a cult. It's like a garage band, punk band, cult hit. It's still people in Europe.
People know it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called "You Ain't No Friend of Mine." It's just got...
It's amazing with the internet now. That stuff can resurface. I've known some musicians that, man, their old demos or something that maybe a couple friends had, it gets out somewhere, and some of their modern-day fans start downloading. Hey, man, where did they get that? You know, and
I know.
Things just live forever now.
Well, these kids, you know, they're really into that. So anyway, we went through that deal, and then time came where it was time for me to, you know, pursue my education. I was a pharmacy major, actually, in college.
Going to school in Austin?
And, well, and so I had to go to Austin because that's where the pharmacy
college was. Oh, okay. Oh, I see.
So the guys, the Sparkles, moved to California, and they were going to go out there and seek their fortune out
right.
there. And so I moved to Austin and got involved, you know, with the Austin music scene at that time.
So who were the first guys you sort of met or fell in with down in Austin?
Oh, first guy I ever met was Ernie Gamage, actually, who was a...
Yeah.
You remember Ernie?
I know the name,
he played
yeah.
bass for Charlie Hatchett at the time. And so ran into a guy, had a little band called Georgetown Medical Band. We played for a while.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's like club gigs,
sure.
the Saracen and the New Orleans Club and
right.
the Jade Room and all those. And then I managed to get with the Lavender Hill Express.
Yeah.
Now, they were the hot local band, Rusty Weir.
Rusty Weir in that, okay.
You know, who, as you know, just passed away.
The great Rusty Weir, yes.
In the last few months.
Yes.
Rusty was a drummer in that band.
And, okay.
And they were the hot band in town. So I had my little M3 organ, and I managed to
get in there with them. Okay.
This would have been 1968.
Okay, yeah.
And so we did that, and then I played with a couple of other bands called Genesee, of which John Inman, Leighton DePenning, Travis Potter, who was, Jerry Potter.
Yeah.
Todd Potter's brother. You know, Todd was a guitar player for the Bubble Puppy.
Right, right.
And he's still around down in Austin. So about in the early 70s, Michael Murphy came to town.
Right.
And so at this time, I was without bands.
Now, where did Murphy come from?
Murphy came from Wrightwood, California. Now, he's an Oak Cliff boy, too.
Okay,
He grew up in Oak Cliff in Dallas.
Right.
And he had gone to California to seek his fortune, and he was, of course, a singer-songwriter, kind of in the folk circuit back then.
Yeah, he was doing more of that kind of thing.
Yes.
A little more than you'd been around to this point.
Yes. He had been in California, you know, looking for a record deal. And he lived in Wrightwood, California, up there in the mountains. And so he made these periodic trips back to Texas. And there was a folk singing circuit. It was called the College Coffee House Circuit back in those days.
Yeah, singer-songwriters.
They would book these college coffee houses, and there was a series of rooms in Colorado and Texas and places where these guys would go around. And so he made his swing through Austin, and I'd heard so much about him, so I went to see him on a Monday night. It's in January 1972, and
this sounds like a seminal moment coming up here.
He walked off the stage.
Yeah.
After the first set, walked directly up to me. He said, "Gary P," he said, "I've heard a lot about you. How would you like to play bass in my band?"
Is that right?
Right. And I said, "I'd love to." I'll go around one more time. So that's how, you know, he had a deal with, he made that Geronimo's Cadillac record with A&M Records.
Right.
So we got to go to Nashville. Bob Johnston, who's a very famous and successful producer,
was
a producer. And you know, so I was the band guy. See, Murphy had never played with a band.
Right. So, were you kind of the band leader, arranger kind of guy a bit?
Well, it's just I had all the band experience. You know,
could play,
I knew how to kind of put the band together and lead the band and a harmony singing and all that.
So everybody watched you for the changes in the show if they didn't know what was happening.
Well, I guess so. They probably wouldn't admit that, but
that's the whole trick, you know, is to be that guy, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's the determining factor on
right.
keeping it going.
So, you know, we did that. We made a couple records, the Cosmic Cowboy and the Geronimo's Cadillac record with Michael. And Jerry Jeff moved to town about the same time. Well, Jerry
from Jeff, New York City, originally, right?
Right. And he came from Key West.
He'd
been out in Key West.
With you know, Jimmy
that's
Buffett.
Mm. He and Buffett were buddies back in those days.
Yeah. There's a lot of mythology surrounding that trip in there. I don't know.
So, Jerry Jeff came to town, and so he started using us too.
Mm-hmm.
And every time Murphy would book a gig, Jerry Jeff would book the opening act.
I see.
And every time Jerry Jeff had a gig, they'd book Murphy for the opening act.
So you guys were just on
stage
all night.
So we'd just play one, and then we'd play the other.
Cool. Yeah.
And then it came a time where the Jerry Jeff thing kind of, I don't know, it's a series of events took place that we ended up going with Jerry Jeff.
Yeah, right.
Well, they all did. I stayed with him for a while. That's when I went to England with him.
And wrote a song and, over there.
And that's when I wrote the London Homesick Blues.
Was it just you and Murphy over there? Were y'all doing like a duo kind of thing?
Well, we were over there doing, he had an EMI record deal.
Right.
And so they were over there doing press and promotion for the release of that Cosmic Cowboy record.
Right.
And so, we got to go to Abbey Road Studio.
Oh, did you really?
We did a mastering and everything. Got to hang around Abbey Road Studio one day.
I went to it one time. I just got to stand outside. I didn't get to go in.
Was it back when they had, it was the old console?
Oh, yeah. Well, this was, what year would this have been, maybe?
This would have been 73.
Okay, so not long after, you know, the Beatles were in there. I mean,
it had the big knobs, you know, and those faders where they had mixed down to four different submixes.
Yeah, and then bounce it, you know, have it put it all on two tracks and then open it up again, like the old four-track recorders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we did that, and then we ended up going over, when we went to Luckenbach in August of 73, Jerry Jeff invited me to come down and help him make that record.
Viva Terlingua?
Yes.
Yes.
And so
I got about eight copies over there against the wall, if you need one.
So, you know, that's when we cut the London Homesick Blues.
How did you write the, not to get off point here, do you have people ask me about writing songs sometimes. Yeah. Some you really remember, and sometimes you're like, I had it for a while, I don't know. Was this something that, you know, do you remember kind of where you were?
Oh, absolutely.
Where were you?
Well, see, Murphy would put me up with his brother-in-law who lived in London.
Uh-huh.
It's a very nice, fashionable apartment area.
What part of town? Do you remember where it was?
Well, near Hyde Park, Oxford Street, you know.
Yeah.
Montague Square is a very fashionable thing. The Beatles lived there at one time.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, Murphy's original wife was Brian Epstein's secretary.
Is that right?
Diana Vera.
Brian Epstein, manager of the Beatles, of course.
Right.
Yeah, man.
So she was his original secretary, and she'd come with them, the Beatles, in 64 when they first came, and then eventually migrated to L.A., and that's where Mike met her and married her.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ryan Murphy, you know, who's had several hit songs with Michael, is their son, and he was 2 years old at the time.
I see.
So her in-laws were there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're staying over there, kind of.
I'm staying with her brother and all his roommates. Well, they go to work every day. Mm-hmm. The heat was off, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
During the day.
Keep those bills down.
It went off in the morning and came off, and it came on in the evening.
Right.
So you're just
stuck there all day.
I was there by myself for days in, days out. And one day I picked up the guitar and I looked out. It was real dreary, rainy, kind of like it is today.
Sure.
And I said, "Well, it's cold over here, and I swear, wish they'd turn the heat on." And so I had time on my hands, and I just took it as a project. What I was trying to do was just mix up British phrases and Texas phrases.
Had you written a ton of songs up to that point?
No.
It doesn't sound, I mean, just from your backstory, it doesn't sound like
just a very few.
Okay,
very
so this few. Was kind of one of the first songs you ever wrote. I mean,
it is, really. And then when we recorded it, Luckenbach, it was the first time it had ever been performed.
Recorded, yeah. Is it really?
Performed. I mean, we had never even played it.
Do you have it written
before.
On a napkin or something? Or
guys in the band, we had picked it out under the trees. Bob knew the bass changes.
Yeah.
Of course, if the bass player knows it, you know, we can play it.
Livingston,
you know,
then you're off and running.
So we played it, and the crowd went nuts. And then that show, you know, they came out to me. Michael Brodsky, who was Jerry Jeff's producer, came out and said, you know, we're going to put this record on this album, on this song.
Right.
And we'd like for you to come over and rejoin the band. And so that was when, you know, I left Murphy.
Right.
And went full-time with Jerry Jeff. And this was in 73. So
right.
So we did that whole Jerry Jeff thing, you know,
touring and just
went nuts, you know.
So what were y'all doing in those days? I mean, you hear stories about, you know, you guys being here and there, and did y'all tour the whole country all the time? I mean, it's hard to get a sense of it for me as a young, you know, kind of a guy, you know, Jerry Jeff Walker, but I think it's hard, I mean, even for me and a lot of these younger guys, to get a sense of what he was doing in the 70s, and a lot of those guys, but
we were flying,
give us a sense of it.
All over the country.
Yeah.
We were just using little tiny amps. And we put all of our equipment, and we had a big berth. It was like a trunk, kind of like this. And we'd ship it on the plane. And They didn't have guitars acoustic with plugins in those days. You had the mic acoustic guitar.
Stand right up.
You had
to
mic a piano or put that helping steel or something on it, you know.
Right, right.
And so it's very almost acoustic situation with very small electric amps that distorted and so it was kind of a combination of folk and rock.
So what were some of the more memorable shows you remember doing with that outfit, with the Jerry Jeff Walker gang?
Shoot, you know.
I mean,
Willie's Picnics.
Yeah.
got, you know, the old San Francisco Music Hall.
Yeah.
Santa Monica Civic Center.
Oh, man.
You know, I mean, we played all the East Coast, West Coast, Canada, Chicago, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Everywhere.
You know, the Southeast.
Big rooms, too. I mean, at festivals and all.
Big rooms, yeah. Mostly, a lot of times, it was concert type of thing. In a big auditorium thing, it would hold 2,500 people or something like that.
Golly.
And then the one over here at in Rice University campus.
Yeah.
That big hall, we sold that out one night. Everywhere we went, people went nuts.
So was it really that record? I mean, of course, everybody knows every song of that record.
It was
a
stone cold hit. And
it
came right at the right time. And, of course, I mean, Jerry Jeff was the biggest thing in Texas. This was before Willie got traction and Waylon Jennings. It was even before those days. You know, those guys used to open for us.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's what I like to say about
Jerry Jeff.
Everybody.
He was kind of contrary to ordinary. He wouldn't cooperate with record executives and stuff like that. And
known for being a little difficult at times.
Yeah.
Jerry Jeff. That got a laugh.
In my opinion, I think he kind of lost the opportunity to move up to the huge level that like Willie did. Did all that and then it just got crazy. Those were crazy times, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get into our next segment here. Man, that was great stuff there. Good grief. None of these 22-year-old guys have that. God bless them. Maybe they will one day. Lots of fun. We're having a great time here with Gary P. Nunn. We're going to get more into, man, his solo career, which has been going, gosh, how long has that been now?
Well,
I mean, would you say
took
solo?
In 1980 is when I
officially
started on my own.
Man, good 30 years to cover here in the final section with Gary P. Nunn. Y'all stay around. Be right back on the podcast. Stay tuned.
Got to put myself back in that place again. Well, when you're down on your luck and you ain't got a buck, in London you're a goner. Even London Bridge has fallen down and moved to Arizona. Now I know why, and I'll substantiate the rumor that the English sense of humor is drier than the Texas sand. You can put up your dukes or you can bet your boots, but I'm leaving just as fast as I can. I wanna go home with the armadillo. Good country music from Amarillo and Abilene. The friendliest people and the prettiest women you ever seen.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Call us here, 817-733-5256. Man, we got the studio here, Pro Tools. Oh, man, guitars, more guitars and amps and drums than anywhere. We'll make your record here. Or call me, Phil Pritchett and the Full Band, same number. Book Phil Pritchett and the Full Band. You might be thinking to yourself, Phil wouldn't want to come play in my backyard. He's just so busy. He would never want to do that. Let me tell you what. I know Gary P. Nunn's played a few shows like that in his day. Those are the ones you want to play, in my opinion. The more I play, You still go play? You play for people like that all the time, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, the great Gary P. Nunn is here. Man, I'm still just reliving all my fresh input here in my brain from the way London Homesick Blues was written, recorded, and took Gary P. Nunn and Jerry Jeff Walker around the world. Great stuff, man. Great stuff there. Thanks for sharing that all with me and the listeners. I want to get more into, you are a survivor in every sense of the word. I mean, you don't have to tell you that a lot of those guys went off to California, or last you saw them was some, you know, hotel room in Miami or something. You just never hear from them again. God love them. But here you are. We played the stock show last night with you, and gosh, I'm just sitting there. I'm like, man, I've seen you play on and off all through the years, and you know, you haven't lost a thing. You're still doing your thing. And when you came off stage last night, you had that look in your eye that guys get where they. It's great to see you can still just get lost in your stuff. You know what I mean? You know, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
You can tell when someone's bored and you're kind of like, man, he just kind of walked off like, glad that's over. But not Gary P. Nunn. He came off last night and I was like, you couldn't get too close to him for just a couple minutes. You
know,
he'd let him cool down
that.
For a minute. Yeah, I'm just kind of like, we just kind of stood back. Man, it sounded real good. So still doing it. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I'm just
longevity.
Having more fun now. I attribute it to the group of people that I'm working with now.
Well, and who might that be? Who would you include that in that conversation?
Have, you know, I have three really talented and good-looking young people. Bo Johnson from Round Rock, Texas.
Yeah, kind of a reasonably new band, about a year and a half.
Bo and Derek Groves and Bracken Hale. And then my buddy John sitting over here, he's a tour manager and the techie guy and keeps us all together.
The guy behind the guy.
We have a really efficient little machine.
It's a cottage industry, right?
Yeah.
It's the music business.
And I always said I was the bottom line in the music business. You know, we talk about when I went on my own. I had a little Chevy pickup truck with a short wide bed I bought a horse trailer and I put the equipment in the horse trailer and they'd throw the guys in the back of the van and, you know, we'd drive to LA for $300 a night, you know, stuff like that. And the guy, but back to now, the guys are so, just cooperative and easy to work with and they want to do this thing. It's not like they're just, got a gig and wait until the next gig. And
I love that you wore the white hat and they all wear the black hat. Is that intentional?
Well, no, it just happened that way last night.
In our band, I wear a black shirt and I make the other guys wear a white shirt. You know, it's kind of
contrast.
It's a little contrast.
That's right. Focus some attention on the star.
Indeed, when I played with you for the first time in Galveston.
Oh, boy.
We played
with David Allan Coe on the beach.
David Allan Coe on the beach. And I met you for the first time. You were there in a nice looking pair of boots, plucking on a Stratocaster, drinking a beer, and we talked, and you couldn't have been nicer.
I remember.
Very fun. But yeah, you did point out, and this maybe goes along with your truck and trailer story, you had at that time like maybe an old budget, kind of a big moving truck kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Later on, we bought a...
And you said, man, that's a money-making son of a bitch right there.
Yeah, well,
I was kind of like, really?
The box. It was like a rider truck that had a little passageway between the drivers.
Had some furniture in there and stuff like that?
Furniture in there. Man, you climb up in there, go to sleep. You know, that was backstage, and that was our bus. It was a money-maker, you know.
Yeah,
we put, like... 400,000 miles on that truck.
Are you kidding? Is that right?
And then I got a band they were a little used to something better, I guess. And they said, we're not riding in that death trap.
Yeah, right. Some legal issues at some point.
They made me go get a van, so that's where. But I kind of miss that old truck. I like to just get up there and
So you sort of stay. So when you started playing, man, you kind of just have a trailer, a truck, kind of pack light a little bit.
Absolutely.
Did a lot of solo shows.
Like
too,
I say, we paid $300-$500, and of course the musicians just kept going and going through and going through.
Sure, they're there for a little while.
And come and go.
Right.
And every time you have to punt, you know.
Sure.
As you know, as a band leader, every time the band's, especially if it's a bass player, you know.
Bass player and drummers are bass players are worse probably.
Now they got to know it, or you're in bad shape.
A good drummer, you just say, hey, man, train beat. Just kind of want to, here we go. And you can get through the night at least.
But if the bass player misses it, everybody in the room knows it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So anyway, you know, since 1980, I went on my own. I've made several records. I think I have about 12 or 13.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them are compilations.
That's right. Live records, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But it's just been a series, you know, working every single weekend. You know how hard it is. If you got to make a change in the band or one drops out on you, you know, you got to find one.
That's
you know,
right.
From Monday till Friday or something like that.
That's right.
So it's just the... So it's been hanging on, but going back to the guys I have now, they're solid and they're dependable, and they seem to enjoy, you know, this trip that I'm taking them on.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so that has made all the difference in the world, my attitude.
Recently, yeah,
and,
sure.
So I just, it's a joy and a thrill, and I'm getting to play guitar now, you know.
I'm
still a utility guy. I'm the second guitar player because we've got a great guitar player. And but I'm getting to play more. I keep it to a four-piece band where there's room for Gary P to play some. So I'm finally learning how to do what when I was a kid I wanted to do. You know, 50 years later,
right.
I have the opportunity to do it.
So you still feel like you got a lot of frontiers to conquer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you still write a lot?
Well, I write a little.
Yeah.
Speaking of my business,
you know,
I have a publishing company. When I was in England at that, with the Abbey Road Studios, I met a guy named, what was his name? His name is Carlton. He was such an independent, he was a publisher.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sat there and talked to me and he said, yes, I'm a publisher, and I published 90 of the top 100 tunes in the hit parade this week. I went, wow. You know, said, yes, I have
sounds
to go get
good,
my songwriters out of jail and always getting drunk. And so, and anyway, he kind of inspired me because that comes natural to me of finding a song.
Right.
And placing it, I'd be a perfect A&R guy. You know?
Now, how do you talk about placing a song? Like you're talking about, like what?
Well, I'm talking about you know finding a song and what artist that it would be very complimentary for.
Right.
So I've had a little bit of luck. I placed some songs that did very well with Jerry Jeff, and I placed a couple with Willie. And back in the days when people would cut. Other
people's songs.
Stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
now everybody's
right.
a songwriter. Nah, I do my own stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of us bad, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Or they co-write, you know, which means
they
might take one of your songs, change a few lines, and now you're in for 50%.
So, you know, my deal is says, well, I'll gather up this publishing company, and I will record everything that I publish.
Right.
So that's my demo, you know.
And here it is.
That way I'm securing the copyrights and the guys that are songwriters that I work with. But the point is that I don't have to write because I have a wealth of material to draw on.
Your own and other people's? Or?
Yeah. It's if I can't find a song that I want, you know, I'll write it. But if I can find it, I'll use it.
I see.
Then we got partners. We got two of us working for it instead of just me.
That's great, man.
So in the process, I built quite a publishing company. Probably have.
Do you acquire the rights of other songwriters?
I mean, yes.
Somebody says, hey, you know, I got these old songs that are just sitting here, and you might say, hey, let me see if I can move them around.
Well, mostly I just say I'll cut it and I'll promote it for
right,
you.
Right, right, right.
And so, you know, what money I generate, you know, we'll split it. And
sure.
But there's been several songwriters that I've taken an interest in that, you know, that now they're. Their careers are full blown.
Like who would that be?
Well, Larry Joe Taylor for one.
Okay, sure.
Davin James.
Okay, yeah.
Tommy Alverson.
See, I didn't.
Brian
Burns. Yeah. So these are guys that you kind of
guys
maybe
like
helped
I
along.
I was the first to cut their tunes.
Sure.
And it shined a spotlight on them, and they
able to go out
they
under
took
that, their own name
take that and is a little springboard and go and make their own careers. And so,
that's very cool. I didn't realize you'd had that much connection with
those guys. I could name you know several that have done well that I'm, but those are the ones that stand out in my mind. You know, Rick Cardwell. You know. He's passed away now, but recently. But I started out with him. You know, they ain't nobody but me. And Jerry Jeff cut the Dear John Letter Lounge.
Right.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a Rick Cardwell tune, the old rocking chair. And
How did the London Homesick Blues song get tied up with Austin City Limits? How did that come?
They just picked it up. They were starting that program. They're looking for a theme song,
and that was just the one they wanted.
That was the one that identified.
Did they come to you for that, or did you have a publisher with that? Or
yeah, they came to us for that.
Yeah,
and they started their program, and that was the theme song for 35 years.
I guess. Getting a check every quarter for $50.
Yeah, that PBS royalties is. I think it's about 0.00001.
But it's in there.
Cent, but it's there, by golly. It's coming. There.
Man, that's what people know that tune, man. If they didn't already, you know, just a whole new. I mean, you've got to just have people. You can't go anywhere in the country music or music world with people not knowing that song and that show.
Well, it has struck a chord out there. Right. People seem to like it.
Yeah. I was pleased to see one of your records that I had. Several years back was your Live at Poor David's Pub.
Oh, uh-huh.
My band did a Live at Poor David's Pub right before he moved. But in fact, I think we dedicated an entire show to the legend of David Card. Uh-huh. That was some entertaining radio for our podcast listeners out there. Kind of a PG-13 rated show, I think, that time. But what a legend he is. You know, we talk about some of these club owners and things and, you know, it's always kind of good old days syndrome, but you wonder if they're out there like him. It seemed like back in the day, I mean, even all the way up into the kind of the early 90s, you just kind of had to be a guy like David Card, a guy that
right.
slept in the bar and just right. knew all the words and hung out with the musicians. And you go play so many places now that it's a corporation owns yeah. it or something. You know, you're just going in there and you're playing your show for your fans. Right. That's who you're there for. But we played a lot of shows, like Kent Finley and
right.
Chino Street. You go play for Kent. You know, whether there's anybody there or not, you're kind of like, man, Kent asked us to play, so we're going to go play.
Absolutely.
You know, so we show up. But those guys are...
It's those kind of guys that have made a music scene guys like us.
Right.
You know, the David Cars and Tim O'Connors, you know,
yep.
of course, Tim has worked for Willie for so many years, mm-hmm. but he was a club owner, had a club called Castle Creek where the little Texas music thing actually mm-hmm. got its start
yeah,
in
yeah.
Austin before we could play the Armadillo.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And it's those kind of guys that they're so devoted to the music
right.
and the whole scene that really make it happen for guys like us.
That's right. So. What do you see when you see a young guy starting out or somebody come to you and say, hey, Mr. Nunn, I'm 23. Man, I got 10 songs. And, man, my uncle believes in me and my friends believe in me. And, man we got the money, man. That's no problem. And, man, what would you tell a guy like me? Here we come, you know. Do you look at that and think, man, it's really great to see, or does your heart sink a little bit? What's your response to something like that?
No, it's great to see because it's what I've always, worked for was to help build a Texas music industry.
Sure.
So that we wouldn't have to go to L.A. or Nashville.
Right.
New York to get a record deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then nowadays, and also... teach them that you can make your own record.
Right.
You know, I think I was the only one, I can't remember anybody, the first one to actually make his own record.
Yeah.
It didn't have a record deal.
Right.
And, so these young ones, they're starting out having the benefit of, you know, have guys like me who started from scratch and didn't ever have a record company or
right.
anything, or didn't have a manager, didn't have an agent.
Right.
It didn't have a publicist, you know. What I tell them nowadays is man, just go for it.
Yeah.
Because some of these kids, you know, I first hear them and I say, well, you know, I don't really see. Next thing you know, they're blowing the roof off of something.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
driving a Prevost down the road and making 40 grand a night.
Yeah.
So.
I know several. Yeah, so do you. Yeah,
I would never say to anybody, you know, that you know you better quit now.
Yeah, yeah.
So many of them
have
surprised me, but you know the business part of it, absolutely. You know, you got to definitely strike a balance between you know the party scene,
sure,
and you know and take it and treat it like a business, because it is your business.
That's right.
And there's so much more to it than just making a record or making a record.
Right.
That's just the first step, you know.
You got to have five bass players' numbers in your phone and the drummers and all that stuff we were talking about.
But you get all that
keep
together,
it running. Yeah.
You get to the part where, the publicist.
Yeah.
Is just about the most important person in this whole.
Yeah.
And
how good a job they do.
Because it's all a media thing.
You know,
the people get all their information from the media.
Sure.
And they follow what the media does. And the media is just one guy who writes a column or something like that. But people follow that. Like, you can be the best band in the world, but if the media doesn't take notice of it.
Right, right.
Then it didn't happen.
Right, right.
And so, I would say, you know, one of the first things to do, make sure you budget having a publicist, someone to go out and get your name in the newspaper, get your name in magazine articles, and of course radio and TV, you got your name has got to be in front of the public in the media. My motto is the media is stupid.
Right.
You know, if you're not in the media, we're in a media world. You know.
That's right.
If you're not digital, you don't exist in
the real world. That's right.
You can be standing right beside you and people wouldn't pay any attention, but if they were watching you on a TV, they go, "Wow!"
You know, it's like you. Hey,
it's a strange dichotomy there.
It is.
I call it the mind trap of duality. You know,
that's
like
right.
You got to be unreal to be real, and you've got to be real to be unreal.
That's right. And it's even stranger now. I've found you probably have too. Is just we've kind of come up. My band is sort of the internet era, and unlike maybe in the 70s, where maybe all the information you could get on yourself or Jerry Jeff would be they had some interview with him in some magazine, and you think, oh, okay. But these days, if you see a little piece or something, you can go online. And you can find out where the guy lives. I mean, and see pictures of. I mean, you can know everything. So, you know, I'm out here playing. You know, a few years back, you're just doing a tip jar gig or something, and people are recognizing you if you're in that scene. If you're on some college campus or something. Hey, man, what's going on? I'm kind of like, how does this guy? Right. Just say, well, if he's one guy that went online and fished around, there's everything I've ever done's out there.
It's made all the difference in the world.
It's amazing.
See, now you don't have that record company you and the people.
And the audience,
And you don't even have the radio stations.
That's right.
Between you and the people.
Right.
So in my own career, I mean, since the thing is, it's just flourished because the people are coming to me in droves now.
Right.
You know, and I never could get to them before because I couldn't get radio airplay. And
now there's just that sense that, it used to be you'd see a band and you're like, How could we contact that band about coming to play at our event? And, man, there was just, if you couldn't talk to them, it was who to call? You just had no idea. Now, you probably get emails all the time. Hey, Gary, I'm having a barbecue down here at the ranch. How much did it cost
you? Oh, you can eat and beer.
You get back to him or forward it over to Chad. Just, hey, man, get with this guy or something. They do know where to find you, and the more visible you can be, or the more accessible, I guess you could say you could be, and you're very accessible to your fans at shows, and the more you can do that, the better success you're going to have, I guess.
Well, yeah. The accessibility part, I question, because I agree with you, my own nature.
Yeah.
But the business part of it, the more inaccessible you are, the more money you can make.
Yeah, you think that's true? You think that's true?
Oh, absolutely.
Like how so? Because we have discussions in that.
Well, just think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. If think about the difference in the scene of a guy that he's a star attraction and he gets there before the show and he goes around and sits down and talks to everybody in the audience.
Right, right. He's just eating a burger while he's setting up his hand.
There's no grand build up. You kind of wander on stage. There's no curtain. There's no lights on and off and everything.
Sure.
You know, that's a whole different scene than that mystique is, everybody's sitting waiting and waiting. Okay, here he comes. You do the show and he's gone.
That's right. That's right.
And so your exclusivity.
That's showbiz.
Yeah. That's show business. I'm not inclined to do that. I want to get out there and sit down and talk to everybody at their table before the show and on the breaks and everything else, which I shouldn't do. And
people
shouldn't do that because it's just not good show business.
Yeah, just remain hidden a little bit.
People expect, they have their expectations of how a star behaves.
Right, right.
And if you don't behave that way, they're disappointed. You know, they go, well, he's not really a star. You know,
he's just a guy like us.
He's nothing special.
He's a nice guy. Forget him. That's why so many jerks are millionaires, right?
Yeah. I'm going to write a book. You know, I tell you, the bottom line in the music business, and
I'll buy it.
It part of it is about how to behave and not behave.
Right.
If you want to be a star,
yeah, that's right.
You know, there's some things you just don't do.
Some
things that you must do.
Man,
so.
Well, man, I'll buy that book. Yeah, you need to get to work on that.
Yeah, I need to. I swore this year I was going to start. All I have to do is get up there and just write the first page, and then I'm gone.
That's right.
I don't know why. I got other little irons in the fire.
There's a market out there with a lot of young guys, and guys starting out, and even guys have been playing for a long time, you know. There's an insatiable appetite, it seems, for information, for you know, going to websites and just, hey, let's see what this guy has to say about this or that, you know, and you know, any sort of opinions and information. There's a hunger for that out there, you know, people moving in their lives. Well, man, I couldn't be more grateful to the great Gary P. Nunn for dropping by on this cold, rainy day to the P2 podcast. Man, we've just had a great time talking here. He was so open with all of his business things he works on. The old days with Jerry Jeff and the starting out, going all the way back to high school. We've covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah.
Well, man, there's still a lot to be told. We'd have to get you back in for maybe part two and dig in a little deeper on some of these things.
Sure.
At some point.
I'd love to.
You come to Fort Worth frequently. I don't know, about once every month or two, three,
well,
something?
I don't know. Since I don't have the White Elephant or gig anymore, which used to be my regular gig.
Oh, yeah.
Heck, we'll just drive over here.
Hey, well, you know, we're here every day recording.
No big deal.
At the studio, Larry Dillon's studio here, Pro Tools, all the great stuff. Call us and come record, 817-733-5256. Thanks again to the great Gary P. Nunn for being here. And we will see everyone else next week, same time on the P2 Podcast. Be good, and we'll see you then.
You ask me what I like about Texas, I tell you it's the wide open spaces. It's everything between the Sabine and the Rio Grande. It's the Llano Estacado, it's the Brazos and the Colorado. It's the spirit of the people who share this land. It's another burrito, it's a cold lone star in my hand. It's a quarter for the jukebox boys, play the sons of the mother of the rundown band. Well, you ask me what I like about Texas, it's the big timber around the Nacogdoches, driving El Camino Real down to San Antonio. It's the river walking the Tierras, jamming out with Bongo Joe. The stories of the Menger Hotel and the Alamo. You remember the Alamo? It's another burrito, it's a cold long star in my hand. It's a quarter for the jukebox boys, play the sons of the mother loving funk house band.
sons of the mother loving bunkhouse men. Well, you ask me what I like about Texas. It's blue bonnets and Indian paintbrushes. It's swimming in the sacred waters of Barton Springs. It's body surfing the Frio. It's Saturday night in Del Rio. It's crossing over the border for some cultural exchange. It's another burrito. It's a cold lonesome in my hand. It's a quarter for the jukebox boys to play the sons of the mother loving bunkhouse band. The bunkhouse band. Well, you ask me what I like about Texas. Well, I could tell you, but we'd be here all night long.